and welcome. You're tuned in. This is the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. We've got a great show lined up for you today. This is a story that has been pointed out to me through the years from a myriad of listeners, and I've been unable to acquire a guest that was ready to talk about it or had enough information. And luckily, a good friend of ours, Alan R. Warren, has stepped up to the plate. His new book covers this exact topic, The Killing Game, the true story of Rodney Alcala, the game show serial killer. Alan, it's a pleasure to have you back with us. Thank you for joining in today.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Now, you've got, you're the host of the very popular true crime history radio show, House of Mystery, and that's heard in Seattle on KKNW, 1150 AM, alternative talk radio, and syndicated throughout the U.S. and Canada. You've been heard on KFNX, 1100 AM, I believe it was, in Phoenix, Z-Talk Radio Network, and you've been out there. How many books total do you have now on true crime?
I have 6 books out now in true crime, myself.
6 books. And do you really enjoy writing this genre? Or do you ever end up feeling kind of icky after you do this for a certain amount of time, especially with the characters you're dealing with?
You know, I feel pretty good about it most of the time, and it doesn't keep me awake. But I've been working on that book for Jack McCulloch. Remember, he was The Footsteps in the Snow put away in
yes.
Chicago
yeah.
for that 1957. Well, I know him and his family. And I spent a lot of time with him since he's got out this last year here. They live in Seattle. And that has really affected me. And I can't exactly explain why, but that's the first time that it's kept me up at night.
What about it affects you? I mean, just trying to tap into that aspect of it. What bothers you most?
You know, I've been asking myself that because, you know, I'd spend the day with him. We'd go down to the where the ferries dock, and we talk a lot. And I've never seen a happier guy for someone that's been through so much. And I don't know. I can't seem to come to terms with what's bothering me. Maybe the fact that he got put away and the things that were done to him in the name of justice, and now they know he didn't do it. And I could just give you a quick one. Like, for instance, when he was in prison, they would stick him in with cellmates that purposely wanted to kill him. First night in there, he got stabbed in the ear with a toothbrush. Yeah, like, they just moved him around, and they kept his heart medication away from him. You know, he had a heart attack in the hospital or in the prison. Just a lot of things that law enforcement did to him in the hopes that he was guilty, and, of course, now we find out that he wasn't.
Right, and now that that's kind of out there, I mean, how are they dealing with that? What's the restitution, especially in, you know, you're in an essential way, you're torturing this guy by putting him in cells with thugs and murderers, killers, people that want to do him harm, and holding back medicines that are needed. That seems like there should be criminal charges brought up for that.
Yeah, that's sort of what he is going for. It seems to be the most important thing to him is to follow this up with, you know, getting that sort of problem fixed. I just don't know. I don't see that it's, you know, you do a lot of shows too in this area about wrongful convictions
right.
and about how they hold on to it. And so, you know, they've got lawyers and they file lawsuits and they get all the records, but then all of a sudden the police lost all the records.
Right.
You know, and you're like, well, how can that be?
Well, see, shouldn't that be considered like kind of an admission to guilt? That if the police, who are supposed to be held to a higher accountability and who are out to bring justice, are losing things that would A, clear them, or B, indicate that they were wrong, shouldn't that be a criminal case in itself? I mean, it's just too convenient that every time something like this comes up, we lost those files. Well,
yeah.
You know, let's put your ass in jail and put you on death row and let you get stomped about for a little bit while we look for files for you that we've misplaced. I wonder how long that would take before they would remember where the files showed up.
Well, you see, and that's what's even more disturbing, because if you think about it, this is something that happened a long time ago, the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people that originally did the wrong deed. You know, the cops, they changed some of the evidence and they did some of that stuff and got him put away. What bothers me most is it's the police chief now, the people that are in power now, that's trying to cover for something done by previous officers. And to me, that's what's causing such a big problem between the police and society, and why they don't trust the police. And it's things like this, because you cannot answer it any other way than you're trying to protect your police agency. And maybe money, too, would be the other.
Give us a little taste of what they had that they thought could put him away that was legitimate, or at least on the outside appearance looked legitimate, but we found out later was faked and you know, manipulated.
They had absolutely nothing. They had no physical evidence.
And how long was he away?
I think total about 12 years.
How is that possible, Alan?
You know what? it's crazy. You know, if you get the FBI files, which I have, the FBI vetted him, searched him, and because he was just a person in the city, in the town, and cleared him. And in fact, they had another person they thought was the person for sure. This guy would drive in and out of town. He actually was talking to the girls and admitted it 15 minutes before they went missing. Then the girl, that Maria Rudolph, is found on the highway, the little mini highway that takes him to his house. You know, and then so then within 5 months, that same guy gets arrested and convicted of molesting a 5-year-old. And so they had all this, but the judge wouldn't allow any of that evidence in.
All right. Now that he's out, though, what is the legal recourse? Shouldn't that judge be held accountable?
No, because
obviously, yes, they should. But I mean, is the answer. But I mean, why aren't the judges being held accountable in these kind of cases?
Well, because first of all, I'd say the judge has the right to make an opinion. So when his attorneys brought forward the FBI files, the judge had a duty to actually not include them because it's considered hearsay. The body wasn't found across lines, so the FBI research could not be held in court. But you see, and this judge happened to – that was his very first criminal case that he tried. He was a motor vehicle moving violation judge before this. So – and the thing is but this is what bothers me, because the judge had to take a recess for a week, read over all the FBI files as well as the prosecutor. So they knew what was in there and they kept it out and they still convicted him knowing this. That's what drives me crazy, because it looks like we're not looking for the real truth. We're not really trying to get justice and put away a person that really did it. If they would have arrested that guy, he wouldn't have had a chance to do the other 5-year-old girl like he did 5 months later. It's just things like that. Rather than, you know, this is kind of one of those cases where, unfortunately, Jack McCulloch and his family were kind of, I don't know, how do you say, they were kind of like the Steve Avery set. They were not real popular. They didn't have a lot of money. They lived in kind of a not the best area, and his, you know, the dad kept changing jobs and all this stuff. They weren't in with the in crowd, and it's just as well to put them away, I guess, is the idea. The police actually changed the times to make it look like he was guilty.
See, that's unbelievably chilling to me that law, and especially judges in this case, were alerted to what was being said. I don't understand how one segment of justice is not admissible to another segment of justice if, in fact, it can help to clear or at least shed more light on a current case where you are betting on somebody's life.
Yeah.
These shouldn't be games of win or loss. These should be games of justice. And for judges' hands to be tied because, well, you know, we know about this, we understand it, we're going to still have to find him guilty because, you know, this yeah. this is what was caught. I mean, that's kind of tantamount to watching a football game and the ref right there sees the ball gets coughed up as the guy slides past the line for the touchdown, and he's not in control of the ball, and he's there, saw it, hands-on, well aware of it, and then they go to the replay, and they say, you know what, the replay system's not working, we can't get it to work, but because that's an effect and we can't replay it, we're just going to have to call it a touchdown. Even though you've got an eyewitness and somebody that can set this story straight, we're going to have to just discount that. That, to me, makes no sense.
I have to say, and the worst part of this is the officer that actually changed the time by 2 hours to make him look guilty cannot be held accountable because there's a 3-year statute of limitation on officers that do this in Chicago, in Illinois, the state of Illinois. So he could never be held accountable.
And how is that a thing? How is that legal? Because in a sense, that's murder.
Exactly.
Right? You're getting away with murder by penalizing somebody and not being held accountable for it later. It should be like, well, you know what? Yeah, Alan, I killed him. But in my opinion, I was doing it under the best circumstances. So you can't put me away for that. That wouldn't hold up in a court of law. So why are judges and lawyers held above the law?
Yeah. It's just dry, you know. And in fact, when Jack's son first told me about this, about the 3-year, I kind of thought, took it with a grain of salt and said, yeah, okay, you know, it's probably not true. But then you go over to Chicago and you start talking and you talk to the Crown prosecutor and all that. It is true. So you can be a police officer in Chicago, change evidence, convict someone because of it. And 3 years later, nothing can be done to you. I'm still in shock over this. I'm still tangled.
Understandably, that starts to weigh on me. And I wondered if that aspect, especially doing true crime radio, doing true crime books, does that ever, you know, so many people think, oh, it's so icky out there. How can you guys talk about that and it not affect you? Well, of course that does. What affects me more personally are the cases like this where real injustice is being done and it makes you frightened because I don't know how you feel as an author and a host as well. I'm a middle-class white guy and I get nervous because I don't know what is going to happen on a simple speeding violation or something. You know, where is this going to possibly go wrong?
Yeah.
And we shouldn't have that fear. And I'm not against police. I have friends and relatives that are cops. And I completely support law enforcement. But we need to make people much more accountable for their actions, especially when it comes to taking the rights and life away from others by fixing things and making things appear another way in order to make your case.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know what you mean. I was on edge driving around the interstate
right
after meeting the family and doing all this stuff. And then we interviewed the old chief of police of Seattle, and he was talking about how the main reason there's so many shootings with cops is because they're undertrained. They get six weeks of training.
Right.
And then a lot of cops are scared. And if you have a scared cop untrained, it's going to be disaster. And I was like, oh, great. So then I'm kind of driving around and you see a cop driving and it's like, uh-oh, speed limit. Hope my taillights are on. It's crazy.
I tell a story and I told it years ago. I'll refresh it real quickly here, Alan. But when I was a student at Winona State University, there was an altercation going on campus and police were called. And I was walking home. And police drove down into my alley and saw me and they said, I've got a can of soda in my hands. The cops get out and he goes, put your hands on the hood of the car. And I said, pardon me? He goes, put your hands on the hood of the car. And I said, okay. And I've got my soda and I turn my face to the cop and I'm holding the soda. I go, what do you want me to do with the can? To which he cracks me on the wrist with his baton. And then my hand hits the deal. This guy ends up spending the next few minutes kicking the shit out of me in an alleyway in Winona. Right. and handcuffs me. So I'm laying in a thorny bush on gravel and dirt. I've got crap all over my face and everything. And he walks off to go talk to the other cops. And this guy's partner comes up to me and he goes, "What just happened here?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "All I know is your partner's psycho. All I asked him was, where should I put the pop can?" And he just beat the hell out of me. And then I heard footsteps come charging up. He grabs me by the handcuffs and he goes, "Well, this fucking psycho's going to take you to jail." Puts me in the car, just starts railing at me. He goes, "Just give me a reason so I can put a bullet in your head. Just give me any fucking reason so I can put a bullet in your head." And I was like, and I said, "What are you even talking about? What is going on?" They take me in. This Jekyll and Hyde jackass takes me in. I go into the cell, and then he comes walking over with the captain, and he goes, "So what's your name now?" And I said, "Well, it's Dave Schrader." He goes, "See, why couldn't you just answer me when we were standing outside the house?" And I said, "What?" He goes, "If you would have just answered me, you wouldn't even be here tonight." I said, "All I asked you was, where should I put my can of Coke? And you kicked the hell out of me." And the captain turns to him. The guy does this kind of nervous laugh and he goes, "Whatever." And he goes, "No," he refused to answer and he was fighting the whole way. I go, "Oh, hell, I wasn't." And I'm sitting there in the jail, bloody beat up, and I was sweating it. And I'm thinking, "Oh, God." And this guy's glaring at me. And wow. Yeah, that was, and again, middle class white kid. And it was a white cop. You know, and you sit there and you go, "Yeesh." Now, like I said, I know a lot of law enforcement people don't do that. That's not the norm. But I'll tell you what, I sweated every time I was out and about in town after that, because I didn't want to run into that cop again, especially after I was blowing the whistle on him. I left that when they released me, they had nothing on me. They released me. I went directly to the hospital so they could take pictures of the boot mark on my back, the punch marks that were still there a couple hours later. It was unbelievable. And you'd like to think, well, this just doesn't happen. This is, you know, this is the movies, or this happens to ethnic people, not middle class white guys, right? Yeah. It's scary that it can happen to anybody at any time. And there's no holding them accountable. And if you, and I understand why some people then are fearful, because here's the cop you want to call when there's a problem, right? Right. And I don't want to even cross this guy's path in daylight. You know, that's a really scary kind of chilling moment in life. And that was a very brief few seconds. I can only imagine what it would have been like had I been ethnic or been something. You know, I don't like to say that racial issue would have been in play. But if this guy was that angry over nothing, where would I have been if I would have been a person of color?
Right. Right. And that kind of worries me. And I think that's probably why I'm a little more disturbed with this case than any, because I actually believe it. Like I'm starting to really believe all of these things. I'm not the conspiracy guy here, but it's starting to get crazy. And you see stories like this. I just don't know. It really bothers me. So I haven't been sleeping most of the year.
Understandable too. Wow. Well, let's get into the new book. This is something, like I said, a topic that I've had many listeners reach out and they're like, what do you know about this case? And you got to get somebody on. And I have not been able to find anybody, available to speak about this case. And I was very excited when you told me that you had the book coming out, The Killing Game, The True Story of Rodney Alcala, The Game Show Killer. How did this story first come to your attention?
It was by accident. Somebody brought it to my attention as well. And I just couldn't find enough information about it. So, and at first I didn't realize how much and how complicated the case really was. I was kind of had it on the sideline for quite a while, a few years. I had outlines laid out and everything. And then, when I realized how intense this case was, that's what draws me into writing, because then there's a lot of things to research and everybody's pretty accessible. And so it just sort of all happened, fell into place. You know, if you can get a hold of the cops, you know, like Steve Hodell was one of the first guys to arrest him. Of course, I've interviewed him. You probably have. And
sure. He believes his father was the Black Dahlia killer.
Yeah. And now Zodiac.
Right.
But, you know, so I had his number. I just give him a call and we started talking. And then you find out that that Van Adder, you know, the O.J. Simpson guy, was on the case as well. And then there's a few others. And so just one thing led to another, and it became pretty incredible. It was a great project to work on.
Let's start at the beginning then and get to know a little bit about Rodney. Talk to me about him and his youth and growing up. What kind of kid was this?
Well, he was born in 1942 in San Antonio, lived with an older brother and sister and a younger sister. So he was third of the four, lived with his parents, and, did things that were pretty normal. He was not, most people liked him. Everything was great. They went to Mexico for 3 years when he was about eight because his grandmother was very ill. She was going to die, and so they wanted to spend time there. So when they went down, his father left the family and moved to L.A. So that was kind of the first thing that's a little bit strange, because at first they never did divorce. So it was kind of an unusual case.
And then kind of a case of abandonment then.
Yeah, but at the same time, they stayed close enough to him. It's almost like a parent lived in each place. And even when she moved back with the kids to L.A., they never did live together, and they would still see each other all the time, and the family was still relatively close. So that was kind of unusual. I couldn't figure that out. There seems to be no hate, or nobody talks bad about anybody. It just seems to be how it went. They guess they just decided to live that way.
All right, so a relatively normal upbringing until the separation, the abandonment. Yeah. And then what is he like growing up? Does he go into the military? Is he a good student? What do we know about him?
Yeah, he was a pretty good student. And then he decided to join the military. He wanted to be a paratrooper, and he got in North Carolina. So he went there for his training to be paratrooper, and he was 19 at that time. And things went pretty well. He moved up pretty good. He was had good character and everything. But about a year into it, his father died. And he came home for the funeral and then went back to duty. And everything seemed to be normal, as normals can be. But his mother was home one day cooking back in L.A., and all of a sudden Rodney shows up. And she's like, what are you doing here? And he said, I went AWOL. I left. Didn't want to do it anymore. So she took him and turned him in because she said, you have to do this. And they did a complete, mental evaluation and everything. And they actually discharged him. And they diagnosed him with an antisocial personality disorder. So that seemed to be the first break.
Was that kind of out of the blue, though? I mean, it seemed like he was well-adjusted and decent up to that point. Or was he slowly breaking away mentally after the abandonment of his father and military and all of that? How was that affecting him?
Well, in the last 2 months before he went AWOL, he was a clerk, with the Army, and they said he wasn't like the superior officer said that he wasn't doing a good job. He was usually very organized and very good, but after the funeral, he was very sloppy, didn't do a good job, didn't seem to be interested. And so they kind of placed all of that on the father's death and the problem with that. So who knows? He had done nothing out of the ordinary other than be very kind of depressed and not really do a very good job. His mother actually thought it was just to do with the death. She had no idea that he was having other issues that were creeping up. For her, it was just all he couldn't take his father dying.
Now, when you look back, before we start getting into the crimes that we know about, when you start looking back into his life, have you been able to find any other possibilities or crimes that may be connected to him that had been overlooked all these years?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And this is just to say, it got so bad I was finding so many victims that I actually had to give myself a date to finish, cut it off, and just release the book. I just can't. This case could, this could go on forever, and it probably will. This is going to go on till he dies. You know, we're finding anywhere from 3 to 5 victims a year that comes up positive with his DNA.
It's really crazy.
It's crazy.
Oh, so there's a DNA match on these. This isn't just like you're assuming that, well, you know, he was here and these exact same kind of crimes happened. You're actually able to put him there and put DNA attached to him.
Exactly. Wow. Because a lot of the crimes happened before, but they did keep samples in a lot of them. And now they're, since 2002, they started using the DNA. And then he keeps popping up. While he was in that last trial in 2010, 4 other victims popped up with his DNA. 4. This is like crazy. And top it off, right? I was going to say the New York Police Department has a page up dedicated to him. There's 215 pictures of people in poses, a lot of them sexual and a lot of them were naked, girls and boys. All underage, very few of age, and they're trying to get a someone to identify them. So they, their page is up. It's at the end of the book as well, and on the website I have, because you can go to that page, and if you happen to know any of them or if you recognize someone, they're trying to find out. And all these pictures were found in his locker in Seattle.
Oh, God. All right. Well, let's before we get into that and the depravity of it all, what is the first, you know, after he's out of the military and is now labeled as antisocial personality disorder, goes back to college, gets a job, LA Times is a typesetter, as you said. Now, are there any strange issues at his work? Is he having problems with family, anything at all during this time?
No, actually, the LA Times said he was a very good employee. He had no problems at all. They really liked him, and he was doing well with his mother and his siblings. They got along fine. He seemed to be going along smoothly. That's why his mother, she said that it was just about the death that occurred that threw him. And after he was back home for a while, a couple of months, he seemed to be back on track. You know, he finished his college and got a degree in photo art. He was apparently a really good photographer. In fact, so good that he applied to get in NYU, and he did. And he studied under Roman Polanski.
Well, there's a weird twist of irony.
I know.
Right?
You know, it was one of many.
Yeah, for people that don't know, Roman Polanski still out and living a life and a celebrated award-winning director who is still wanted in the United States for raping, sodomizing a young underage girl after drugging her.
Yeah.
And with all the stuff that's going on in the world, and especially dealing with Hollywood and politics right now, is it not astounding to you when you see footage of him winning awards and celebrities like Jack Nicholson, whose house he was supposedly at when the rape took place, standing up and applauding, standing ovations? Well, yeah. He's European and, you know, it was a different thing and they were experimenting with drugs together and then the sodomizing happened. She was still underage. She still did a crime, or he did a crime. Why are we celebrating this guy? I don't get it.
It's outrageous, actually, but
yeah. And I know he'd gone through a lot with the Sharon Tate murders and everything like that, but my God, it doesn't make it okay to drug and sodomize someone else because you're still dealing with grief and loss. But I digress. But it's interesting that he was training under Polanski at point.
Maybe he got more training than we thought.
Yeah, it would seem. Okay, so he's doing well. How does the train jump the tracks then?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. the first time that we officially knew back then that something happened, it was 1968. And he was driving around in West Hollywood, and he picked up a girl that was 8 years old. Her name is Tel Shapiro. And the thing is, what he did was he would normally he would give them some sort of thing like, you know, can I take your picture? You're really pretty. You know, and back in 68, I guess that was okay. The girl, she got in the car, and then he said, well, I have to take you home because I need to take some pictures with certain equipment. So, of course, she goes along. He takes her home and into his place and starts doing his thing. The thing was, what was lucky about that was a guy had seen this sort of all go down. And so he followed them to Rodney's place and saw them go inside. So he went to a payphone, if you remember what they are, and he called the police and told them. And so the police came to do a checkup and knocked on his door. And as soon as he opened the door, they saw the girl. They thought she was dead. She had been beaten and raped and was laying on the floor. So they went in and he actually escaped out the back door.
Wait, he lets the cops in and somehow is able to escape them?
Yeah, and Camacho, the police that I talked to, he said what happened was as soon as he opened the door and they were talking, saying, we've got a complaint, and he looked down and he saw the girl naked on the floor and there was a lot of blood. So they just pushed the door open, and then he said they ran to the girl, that's when Rodney took off. And see what happened was they thought the girl was dead, but then she moved or coughed. And so all of a sudden, they realized she's still alive. So they were more focused on getting her help than chasing Rodney. That's what he said. So I take it as that. But Rodney did escape. He got away. He just took off out the back door. So the Good Samaritan that was watching didn't see him leave either.
Ooh. All right, now how long is he out and about?
He actually was out for almost 3 years then.
Just on the lam? Did they have a name? Did they know who they were looking for?
Well, no, not really. Well, they know, of course, because that's where he lived, and they knew his name. But he changed his name to Berger and went to New York and started studying with Roman at NYU. So he just up and left. And they put a warrant out for him, and they never found him. And he changed his name, so they had no idea where he was. They were looking. There was a warrant and the whole thing. And then after he finished his studying with Roman, he went – now, I could not believe this. He goes with the same fake name and gets a job at an all-girls school, and he's the counselor.
Oh, God.
He's a counselor at an all-girls summer school. Think about it.
The most vulnerable place in a seat of power, a position of power, and these girls coming to you. Oh, no, this
was
leading the lambs to slaughter, right? How is there not better background checks done?
I don't know if they just didn't do it back then or what the case was, but all of a sudden they hire him and he's the counselor for the girls, and they're all teenage girls at a class and a school, and he's supposed to be helping them, guidance. Oh my! I how do these things happen? You know, that's the sort of why this case kept drawing me, because he's in at a school working. And it was only luck that they found him there. And that was because two of the girls walked into town to the post office to mail letters. And, you know, back then in the post office, they used to have the FBI's top wanted people on there.
Right.
His picture was up. And the girls saw it. And they said, wow, that looks like Mr. Berger, the counselor. And they were like, no, it couldn't be. He's so nice. And so they go back to the school, and they actually mentioned it to the dean. And the dean kind of thought, well, that's weird. So he went to the post office and viewed the picture for a while. Then he called the number on the flyer. And so the next day, the FBI came out and arrested him at the school. And that's where Steve Hodell got into it, because Steve was the detective on the case in L.A., and he flew to the New York area to take him back, extradite him back to California.
But at this point, we only know of this one attack. We don't know if there's others that have happened.
We had no idea. We just thought. And in fact, when they come back, see, by then, Telly Shapiro and her family, the girl that was attacked, all moved out of the country. And her dad said he was tired of all the violence and crime in the U.S. That was it. He took his family and moved. But, you know, and I kind of roll my eyes at that one because where do they move? Mexico. So I didn't.
Yeah, that'll tell you just how bad things must have been at that point for them, right? Boy, Mexico's the safe haven.
It wasn't the country I was thinking of when he said that.
Now with the family out of the country and them wanting to move on and get out and out from underneath this story, they extradite him back. Is there still somebody there to press charges?
Yeah, well, the government still pressed charges against him. So California, the state of California, was still charging him. But because they could get no witnesses and they couldn't get anybody to come back and testify, they plea bargained it down to a child molesting. Actually, I think it was procuring or something about a child. But basically, he was caught doing something with a child. And all they did was give him a 3-year sentence. And he got out within a year.
Now, is he a model prisoner while he's there? Is he a good guy? I'm not trying to protect him or side with him here, folks, but you say, you know, when they go in, is he a good guy? Is he acting decent or is he acting more wacky?
No, he was a good guy. Not good, but he was good prisoner in the sense that he never got any write-ups, he never got into any trouble, never caused fights. And if anything, you see, this is one thing that you learn about him. He seemed to be a very good charmer. He wasn't bad looking. He had the way to talk to people. He did the Charles Manson thing. You know, the girl said he would stare you in the eye and not ever leave, as if you're the only person in the room. Mm. You know, he did that and would touch them and hold their hands. And he was very just, you know, people really ingratiate it. So it was just he had the way to get away with things. So after a year, they let him out. In fact, this is sort of another issue because they let him out in probation. And so what's he do? Within the first month, he gets permission from the parole office to go to New York. Like anything he would ask for, they would give to him. So we had no idea. And this is why.
And this is taking place in what year, just so we can give people a little perspective.
We're talking just in early 70s now. We're probably about 71. And so, you know, he's still doing all these things. See, but nobody had an idea what he was doing. He was going to New York and then come back and go to New York, and he would do these things. And it's only later, that's what we were talking about, the DNAs that's been coming up. Each time he went to New York, he would kill at least one girl, maybe two, and then leave and come back to L.A. And he just sort of kept doing this. He started just randomly picking people. It was crazy.
Did he have a type?
No, that's another thing. He was doing from 8-year-olds to 32-year-olds. He was also primarily doing females, but he also had males and kids. We're talking 6, 8, 9 years old, not adults. It seemed like the only adults that he would kill were the ones in New York. They were the big ones, like that Ellen Hover. She was 23, and she was the goddaughter of Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. And her father owns Ciro's, which is in Hollywood, and it's a big club. And one of his trips to New York, he killed her. So he wasn't. It's just bizarre because you think this is a guy that just got one crime, came back home, and is working for the LA Times again, and everything's hunky dory.
He goes back to the LA Times.
Yeah, and this was kind of, and I don't know, I didn't think of it at first, but it came to me later. They hire him back at the LA Times, and he's working, and that's where they ended up arresting him down the road. And the LA Times didn't even bother doing a check on his criminal record. They had no idea that he had already been convicted of molesting a child. So, it just keeps on going.
Right. Wow.
You know, like little subtle mistakes all the way through, and you have someone that's charming and able to manipulate their way, this is where it goes.
It's twisted. It's scary to know that this happens, and I'm sure it happens today in 2017 that these mistakes are still made. It's much harder, but I'm sure that type of thing, and you overlook some of these people, and then especially if they've pled down the charges against them, you may never know what they're truly even in for or right. what they were in for.
Yeah. Yeah, all it's right. kind of, it's creepy.
So he's done all this, and this is the early 70s. Talk to him. When does he start, when does he appear on, what was it, The Dating Game?
Yeah. Okay. That came along. That was September 1978. So it was the fall season just started, and he was one of the bachelors, and the bachelorette, Cheryl Bradshaw, chose him, actually. And that was a creepy sort of thing, because I've watched it a few times, and I put the transcripts kind of what he said during the game, and I thought that was really creepy. I didn't find him charming at all. I was really surprised that she picked him. He was very...
Right, but you were front-loaded. You went in knowing who this guy was and were icked out by him, and it was a different time and era. Do you think that that's kind of what, you know...
Yeah.
Was he playing in? Was he really any worse than the other long-haired, cheesy mustache, you know, Lotharios of the time?
No, probably not.
All right.
Probably.
So what was the date like? Did she say anything?
No, actually, you want to hear this. She chooses him, and they're all there, and they win this trip for a weekend, all paid, hotel, dinners, you know, it's the whole works. It was a really nice thing, right? They went backstage, and she said that he was so creepy, she wouldn't go on the trip with him. That was it. She walked away from it. She didn't go on the winning trip with him. She said he was just too creepy.
Well, at least she picked up on that vibe.
She got it. And I'm telling you, I sort of think he was creepy on that. I mean, it is the 70s, and they all are sort of cheesy, but there was something different about his answers. You know, like she'd ask him what kind of fruit, and it'd be the same old thing. I'm a banana, and can you describe yourself? And he goes, well, peel me, baby. And it just...
Yeah, but you know, watching the Game Show Network, Alan, and I was a fan of the 70s stuff, the dumb innuendo was huge. Look at shows like Match Game.
Yeah.
Right? And the Newlywed Game. There was a lot of that, you know, tongue-in-cheek, schlocky nature. So to me, that, and I'm not standing up for this knucklehead either, but again, I wonder how much of, it was kind of icky, is because we know what a dirtball this guy turned out to be and what his real intentions were behind the things that he was saying.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. I guess it's easy to look back at it.
Right. And, you know. Well, with our clarity of you know, Monday morning quarterback of seeing all that was laying before us behind us now, right?
Yeah.
So, that's it. But so he makes it on the dating game, wins. She doesn't want to go on the date with him. And was that the only game show he ended up showing up on, or was there other things that he had also?
He actually got on to like three other shows, but he never won. He never got recognized, you might say, like this, where he actually won, and it was kind of a big deal. And the show did well, too, because they repeated this version a few times, which comes into play later, because that's actually how one of the detectives found him, is by watching a rerun that he caught by accident.
Get out of here. No kidding. All right.
So that was, you know, that helped in a way. But, you know, the point of the September 78 is by then he probably had anywhere from 1 to 2 dozen murders behind him already. Wow. By 1978. And during the appearance and right after, probably 5 others that we know about. So he was really doing it by then. You know, he was picking up girls by the twos and killing them, not just one. So he was kind of going all out.
all that crazy 70s and their free love and their hippie movement and their marijuana and their rock and roll music, Alan.
Yeah. No, yeah. Those poor guys. Not like today.
No. So, wow, this, what a creeper. But he, again, this kind of weird ability, almost like you said, almost like Manson, right?
Yeah.
Almost like Bundy in the same sense of the wounded bird, the kind of, you know, oh, I, let me help you. And just, you know, this caring kind of weird thing.
Totally. You know, it's all about love. You're beautiful, you know, and he'd look them in the eyes. And he just sort of had that way.
I wonder how many guys are rolling their eyes thinking, you know how many times I've tried this in a bar and I get slapped or they walk away from me? This guy's taking them home and murdering and raping, and yeah. I couldn't get a date for the longest time. Yeah, that's weird how some people – you do wonder if there is something else at play. And I don't mean that to sound flippant, Alan. I mean that in all sincerity. You know, I know some really great guys who are very good-looking, generous, smart, and they will approach a woman who won't give them the time of day, but you can watch – 10 minutes later, the slimiest looking dirt ball in the joint comes smooshing in and they'll just wrap themselves around his finger. And you sit there and you think, what just happened? In what universe is this guy a better choice over anybody? You know?
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to typecast or judge or, you know, but you do, you get that look in and you think, boy, that took a little to no effort.
Yeah.
And it's weird how some of these guys just have that cloaking. That radar cloaking effect on people.
Yeah. It was, like I said, I compare him to Charles Manson in that way. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, yeah, Bundy is quite much the same as well. You know, I don't get it. I really don't. But, you know.
Well, kind of running through the 70s, you got Julie Johnson in 75, right? She was 13 years old.
Right.
What is it, Ellen Hover?
Ellen Hover. She was the one right. When he flew to New York and right. Got her.
The goddaughter of Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. Jill, what is it, Barricombe?
Barricombe, and that was back in L.A.
She was 19 years old in 77, and she was found across from Marlon Brando's house.
Yeah, you see, by the time the game show came on, at first he would just attack them, and then he started doing things with them, so... He had this idea of placing them, and he would adjust them. So in this particular case, it would be like standing on your knees, and then laying backwards so that you're facing for. And so he would aim their privates right at someone or someone's place because he wanted them to see it. So he placed her spread. Facing Marlon's place so that when he came out, he would see that. And
is that in fact what happened, or did somebody else see it before Brando?
No, it was someone else, actually. It was like a maid or butler or whatever you call it. It was an assistant of Brando, but the cops had to go question him, and he was involved in that part of the case. That's where Philip Van Adder was on the case. But he was starting to torture them. So he would tie them up and then he would burn them and cut them and rape them and then choke them until they passed out. And then he would wait till they regained consciousness and then he would do it all over again. So he started getting into this a punishing cycle with his victims. He got pleasure out of having them for hours and making sure he could help them and make them torture, you know, just he wanted that. That was crazy.
And looking at some, you know, it's interesting. You look at some of the pictures, like when he was on The Dating Game, he almost had like a Ted Bundy look to him.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's then, what I mean. Yeah, a little later on, he almost looks like Richard Ramirez.
Yeah, I know.
All right. I mean, that's like drastically different looks, but he was almost like, if you look at the supernatural side of some of these murders and people, like I said, that there just seems to be something else at play here. It often, you know, you look at some of these guys and there are striking similarities and you just wonder, was there more at play than just a sick individual? Is there something more nefarious behind some of these murderers and what drives them?
Yeah. You know, I try to explore that all the time. It's so hard to narrow down what exactly makes a person go with someone like that? And I have to say, one of the girls too. Now, which one was that? That was one that he got from the beach, and he took her up to the park. This was which one was this? Monica Hoyt? Yeah, Monica Hoyt. She was 15 years old. Picked her up, and he took her up to a park and asked to take pictures, because his scenario was, hey, I'm a photographer. I'm in a contest, and I'm supposed to take a picture of, you know, girls in nature. He would say whatever, and you could win. And quite often they would go along with him. So he would take them somewhere, and then he would take photos, and then he would ask if he could, they would remove their top and that, you know, that sort of thing. And sometimes they would, sometimes they wouldn't. With this girl, Monica Hoyt, what he did was he gave her some marijuana to loosen her up. And then he started attacking her. But this is what's crazy. So a forest ranger, sees them up at the top of this hill, approaches them, and the girl, she screamed, oh, you know, I want to go home. He forced me and all this stuff. So what do? They take them both back to the police department, and they let him go.
Why?
Because he charmed his way out of it. He said that, oh, no. No, no, she came up on her own will, and we were just taking pictures and smoking pot. Sorry, I guess I shouldn't have done that. He charmed his way out of it. They actually thought, and the officer back then, actually, his comment was that they found quite a few younger girls with older men in the park, and they were usually selling themselves. So he just put it down to her doing a trick. So it's crazy.
It's unbelievable. That's wow.
I could not believe the luck.
Alan, there has to be some kind of, you know, listen, I'm not trying to, I know I'm the paranormal guy, but I'm not trying to beat that drum. But in these cases, there's got to be something more to this than that. It's just, how does that happen? How do people just walk through these horrific crimes? And how do you not, to be that dark and yet still be that charming that you could charm your way past the cops who are looking for dirt balls,
yeah,
and looking for people to bust. How are they not picking up on this?
Yeah, and I don't know what you could attribute it to, because,
right.
I mean, what can he, you know, I don't think he's Lucifer, so to speak. Why do people just allow it?
Although, and you it know, just, there were claims that Ted Bundy, in a couple of occasions when he would start to lose his cool, attorneys and police officers would say a strange scent would emit from him that was unearthly. And, right. You know, it does make you wonder if there is something, you know, not the devil incarnate, but is there something driving the ship? I mean, that just seems, and again, maybe it's because I don't want to believe that people are that cruel and heinous and that there isn't something more malevolent behind it, but I mean, this guy's like a living Freddy Krueger, right? I mean, just hack and dash through people and flippant remarks and charming attitude, and you're still the scariest guy on the planet, and people just love you.
Yeah, and that's what he was. But they seem to go on all over the world. But, there's something special about American serial killers that I'm not seeing in the other countries.
Do tell.
Well, just because there's a series that we're publishing, and I've got two of those books, and one was Australia and one is Germany. And what we're doing in this is we go through the basic murder by gun and murder rates of the country, what the laws are, and then we've also overviewed all the serial killers and mass killers in that country. And things like in Germany, I'd say 70% of their serial killers eat their victims, drink their blood. There's a different sort of pattern to some of these countries. Because you hear this all the time about gun control and mm-hmm. all the mass shootings, of course. But there's something special about that in the U.S. That seems to be something that's very American. And why is that? Why is the particular thing that they're doing so different than other countries? Like, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because why is it in Germany they're all eating each other?
I don't know. It is weird, right? There's these different protocols. That's bizarre.
Exactly. It's just there's slight differences in the purpose behind the murder, and I don't know how deep we can go, but maybe future generations can start figuring out why certain types of crimes and killings go on in certain countries and not others. I don't know. Anyway, so that was a little sidetrack. And another thing, so why I'm saying this guy got away with stuff was then he raped the 12-year-old Robin Samso and killed her. And he drove back up to the park, up into the forest. And this is in 1979. Now, this is crazy. So he takes her, pulls over on the side of a gravel road, takes Robin out of the car, and this forest ranger named Dana Crapper drives by and sees them. And she just goes back to her office, you know, her camp. And then the next day she drives by that same area again and sees him and no girl. He's all covered in mud and blood. She again goes back to the camp, says nothing. And then she goes back.
What?
Yeah.
She saw him covered in mud and blood, and she just went back and did nothing.
She did nothing. She told nobody. She did nothing. So this is crazy. It gets worse. It gets crazier. 2 days later, she goes back down to the site. There's no car there anymore. Nobody's there. So she walks down the trail, and this is what she says. She says, "I saw remains of a body. So I was freaked out, turned around, ran back to my Jeep, and went back to the camp." Again, she says nothing. She tells nobody. She's the forest ranger. Like, what? And so, you know, it gets even worse. She's out with her partner, and her partner takes her to that same trail because they were out for something else. And he comes across, and he sees a skull, like a skull kind of piece of bone, and he kicked it at her as a joke. And it freaked her out, right? And she then still tells him nothing. Doesn't say a thing. And it wasn't until almost 2 weeks later when another ranger came up and found the remains and reported it. So you're kind of going, I was like, what is wrong with this woman? Like, what's going on here?
Right. So, okay, once somebody else finds the remains and reports it, if you were dumb enough to have walked away from it repeatedly and did nothing, why would she admit to, oh yeah, I saw that three times. I saw him there go in with her. I saw him covered in mud and blood. And, you know, I saw the remains. And then we went back up and I got a skull kicked at me. And I didn't say anything. What was her rationale behind all of that?
Well, you know, this is the problem. So she still admits nothing. And then her partner talked about kicking the skull. And he didn't realize it was part of a girl, a human. And so they question her, and so she gives up the ghost. Like, she ends up telling them all these things she did. And so they arrest Rodney and for this murder. And so when they've got him and they've got her on the stand, she testifies to some of this. So what this did was when he got convicted of this particular murder – he was put on death row, so he gets an automatic appeal. So the California Supreme Court looked at this and said that they had to vacate it, that it wasn't done correctly, because this woman, forest ranger, was obviously hypnotized.
Hypnotized.
I know. This is the
legitimate response they come up with.
Exactly. They said the police hypnotized her into saying all that.
Uh-huh.
And that caused him to be the conviction overturned. They've tried him three times now on this, and every single time it's because of this forest ranger's testimony. And the third time, They said that she was mentally unstable, and they actually had a psychiatrist give her a review, and because of that, the Supreme Court overturned the conviction again.
Right, but what came first, the chicken or the egg? Did she become mentally unstable because of what she saw in this case? Or was she mentally unstable back then?
The Supreme Court believes that she became mentally unstable when she first came across this, or she probably was already having issues when she first saw the, you know, Rodney with this, with the little girl. And that's why she reacted the way she did. So there was something already going on. And it's just crazy because he's been in three times, and now he got convicted again on this and four others at this time. And of course it's an automatic appeal because it's death row. So he's not, you know, he's not by anywhere done. He's not even close to being done on this. You know, it's crazy. I have to say,
are they not pushing as hard because he was already in jail? He was already, I mean, what's the thinking?
Well, you know what? In the book, I talked to some of the officers, and it seems to be the opinion of police in California that the California Supreme Court, which does these appeals on death sentences, and in fact, the fact is, I have it in the book, they've overturned 65 of the last 73 death row convictions. And actually, the police chief in West Hollywood, his word was that anybody on death row is not going to be put to death if they're in California, as long as we have the blanking Supreme Court that we have. So, I don't know. I know that they keep overturning these things, and people like Akella will never get put to death. It just goes on and on and on.
Right, but there is some justice. The guy's in jail and is never going to get out.
Well, hopefully. I mean, he's in jail now for five more murder convictions, and they're charging him with four more.
All right, well, let's roll back. First of all, he was put in jail for what? Get back to that. The Robin murder, the Robin Samso murder?
Yeah.
That's he was put in jail for that, but kept winning the appeals. So would they let him out, or would he have to stay in jail while the next appeal process went on?
The first one he got out, the next two, no. The next two, no, because by then the DNA started coming in just after 2002, and they started finding out that he was tied to all these other girl murders. And so he started getting charged with other murders.
So were they finding blood, skin samples, seminal fluid? What were they getting from these older cases?
It was mainly blood and semen.
Okay.
And that it was a pretty positive thing, because you're finding out what this is. It's his DNA, and why was he with them? And, you know, so they keep charging him. And during that Samso trial, I have to say, the third one, Robin Samso's mother was in the trial, and she was sitting two rows behind where he was. The whole time the trial went on, she was packing a gun in her purse.
Wow.
And she kept her hand on the gun in the purse the whole time, because she said if he was not going to get convicted, she was going to shoot him. She was only about 20 feet away from him, and she was going to just pull out and shoot him in the head. And so many times she came close to it. And it wasn't until he got convicted she came out and showed the press her gun.
So in 2010, this is after 9/11, folks, she was able to get into a courthouse with a gun?
How did that happen? And every single day, and this was like a 3 or 4 month trial this time. How does they, you know, see, so these things that make you want to write a book.
Now he also takes the path in this third round of Bundy and decides he's going to represent himself in court, correct?
Yeah.
He cross-examined himself?
Yeah, it was crazy.
How did that go?
Well, it was stupid because he would ask himself – he would ask him – most of the people that he cross-examined, first of all, he would say no questions. Or if he did have a question, it would be, so when you found this body, whichever girl it was, because he was being charged at five girls at the same time with this Robin Samso trial. And he would say, did you find – were they wearing earrings? And quite often the person being questioned would say no, or maybe, I don't know. And then he would say, okay, fine, that's all, thank you. That was his only question. And then he asked himself that, if any of the victims had earrings.
What was his answer?
And he'd say, no.
Not that I recall.
No. It was crazy. You see, he was stuck on this thing because they found out he had a locker in Seattle, a storage locker. So the police got the search warrant, went to Seattle, and went through it. And they found tons of, like, they found earrings, and they found, you know, a little kid's jewelry. They found all the pictures.
So, like, he was taking souvenirs.
He was taking things from the girls. And in fact, on the one, there was this pair of earrings that Robin Samso's mother said, well, that's hers. That's my daughter's. I know I bought them for her, right? So it was that kind of scenario. So he was stuck on this, proving that the earrings they found were not Robin Samso's. They were his. He had this pair of little girl's earrings that he owned, and it wasn't the victim. And so he was focused on that the whole trial. That's all he asked about. That's all he wanted to know. And that's what he asked himself about. And a few other things. It was just stupidity at the best.
Oh my God, unbelievable! All right, so he's found guilty. How does this all flesh out?
Yeah, he got on that trial in 2010. He got found guilty of all five girls' murders, with this Robin Samso as well. And he's on death row, and so it's pending appeals. But at the same time now, like I said, other victims are coming up, like the 13-year-old girl, Antoinette Whitaker, I believe that was Seattle, and Joyce Gaunt as well in Seattle.
Is he now forthcoming? Does he want to come, if they leave him off the death penalty, will he admit to more?
I'll tell you what, he wrote his own little book. And Rodney McCullough has a book, and he in it talks about how he didn't kill anybody. And in fact, this goes back to when the very first time, when the very first crime in 68, and when Steve Hodell, the detective, was taking him back to California. And Steve said the first thing I got to ask him was, like, why he did this to an 8-year-old girl, because at that time they thought it was only the one.
Right.
And he turned around and said, Steve, well I don't want to talk about what Rodney Acala did. I'm John Berger. Why would I want to talk about him?
So was he trying to build an insanity plea for himself?
You know, it's one of his many, but he doesn't seem to need this case, because this is insanity, or to say he's nuts, because he just keeps on winning, you know, or he gets put away and gets out in a year. He just keeps on. He can still work. If you think, he's always been able to work, live fairly decent, and go out and survive. And it's only recently now that he's stuck in prison. But I agree.
When did he go into prison? What year?
The last time would have been 2002.
So how long had it been from 2002 to what year between times he had been in prison?
Most of the time since 2002. He's been out twice since.
No, I'm speaking before 2002. Was that his only real stint, except for that 1 year that he'd spent in jail before?
Exactly.
So this guy was active since at least 75.
Oh, yeah, right through 68. The bodies that are coming up now are people that went missing in 1971, 72, 73. And they're just coming up with his DNA match. So, and they're finding them all over in Wyoming and Seattle, in Portland, Marin County, San Francisco.
So they have enough DNA from back then still. How are they doing that? I mean, people that we weren't collecting for DNA, that wasn't even a thought process.
They were doing rape kits in the 70s. So they would take the semen and they would take blood and samples and stuff like that off of, or sometimes hair. And they were taking it off the bodies and keeping them in a rape kit. And one of the good things about, especially California, is they kept all of that, and it's very organized. And they have apparently something like 70,000 rape kits that haven't even been analyzed.
Yeah, there isn't enough manpower or money, they keep saying, which is scary as hell, because how many could we put away? How many people could we exonerate if we were able to process these rape kits? Because you got to guess there's, you know, there's got to be a percentage of people that are sitting in prison for rape that they did not commit because rape kits weren't processed properly.
Yeah, exactly. There's been a lot of mishaps over that whole situation. And it wasn't until 2002 when the court approved DNA to be admitted, be allowed.
Right. Now, so, in 2002, that's when he goes back in, and he's been out twice since then.
Yeah.
For what periods of time?
Not very long. 3 months, and I think the other one was 5 months.
And what would bring him back?
Another rape kit or another discovery of a body that they tie to him. See, and he – now, I can't say this for a fact, but why would he go to New York? And I'm going, well, I don't, you know, I'm trying to think, why would he do that? Why is he flying there, picking up a girl, killing her, and then coming back? And this happened 4 times we know about. So I'm thinking, well, why is he doing this? He would go at the same time, same as in Boston. He would pick it when there was someone going, some mass killer, just like the Hillside Strangler in Seattle. So he started going to Seattle and killing girls. And they would just be pinned under the Hillside Strangler.
Oh, wow.
So same as in New York. We had all these other killers going on. You know, we had the Boston Strangler, and you had the big one that was going on with him was the Son of Sam.
Right.
So he was picking cities that had a fear of mass killing, and he would kill them the same way. And this also plays into why he was taking older girls in New York, like in the 20s and 30s, because he was trying to copy what Sam was doing.
Oh, he was emulating the crime. So right. He was a copycat killer. He was an opportunist killer. He would go find people to kill in the style of other murders that were taking place.
Exactly. And he did it the same way, and he took the same age group. And that's what's confusing, because, you see, of course, then he could come home and the cops would just throw another murder on the serial killer of the time in that city.
Now, has his convictions and all of these DNA tests popping up, have they started to exonerate innocent people that have been put away or have been identified as the possible perpetrator? Has that clearing started at all?
No. And for the most part, they lumped it on other serial killers that were in the time. The Hillside Strangler was blamed for 3 others that Acala did. But they didn't even look into it.
Well, it's interesting that he would pose the bodies, because that was done very much in the sense of like the Black Dahlia killer.
Exactly. And it's funny how that's tied in with Steve Hodell now.
Right.
Right. You know, and he's the guy that's.
So do you think he's ever going to get out? I mean, what is he, 73, 74?
73.
Right. He's 73 right now, and more cases are being attributed to him. How will he ever see the light of day?
I don't think he ever will. I think he'll win more appeals, because it was a lot of these cases were done quite sloppily, and California seems to overturn appeals. I can't say the reason. Of course, the cops have their opinion. You know, it's the goddamn liberal, you know, court, they'll say. But to me, it's like, no, 65 of 73, there's more than just a liberal thing going on here. There's something. So these cases keep getting overturned. So I don't think he'll ever really get put to death. And he's got like, what is it now, 8 more charges against him for murder at this moment. So he's got to stand trial for 8 more trials. So, you know,
is he enjoying this fame? Is he enjoying the attention that he gets?
He certainly is. He's like incredible. He's laughing. He's smiling. He's waving at people. He thinks it's a party. Well, again, I can't speak for him, but he acts like he's in the middle of a party. You know, they bring him in, and he's got the sport jacket on. He's got sunglasses and boots, and he acts like he's.
But he's probably treated well, right? Because he's a schmoozer, so they bring him in. They probably feed him better during the court cases like this than they would in general populace in the prisons.
Yeah, and he's a celebrity, just like Manson. You know, there ends up being kind of an appeal for people like that. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's sickening crazy. Is what it is.
But you know, if you've seen the American Horror Story Cult, that new
right.
one.
Right.
At the very, you know, the way when he gets put in jail, how all of a sudden he has guards doing things for him.
Right. Well, that was the case in Bundy's, Manson's.
Exactly.
Even going back to Capone, they were all treated. Gacy, of all people in Illinois, was treated almost like prison royalty.
Yeah, doughboy. And
yeah, unbelievable.
So I think he's in the same realms. It seems to be a party. You're inviting him to come into a party, and he gets to, you know, he has a he acts
gets
like
to
he's
preen and show off right and in a way he's showing off how guilty he is without having to admit guilt.
Exactly, he's just having a good old time. And he acts like it, and the more they charge him with, the better. You know, he's great. Lots of things to do. He's not bored in prison.
Alan Warren, our guest, The Killing Game, the true story of Rodney Alcala, the game show serial killer. Thanks for putting the book out and making it available all in one place, drawing all of these stories together once and for all in one comprehensive book. That's fantastic.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure talking with you, Alan. We love having you on the show, and I'm sure we'll hear from you again as soon as the next book is hot off the presses. What's your next book you're working on?
Well, they released the Australia serial killers in 1 week, and then Germany next year, and then the Jack McCulloch book will be out in spring.
Well, we will contact you and get you back on when these books start breaking. Thank you very much, Alan. All right, guys. Timmy D's here. It's time to break open the files of dumb crimes and stupid criminals. Well, Tim, there's levels of dumb that sometimes I feel like we can't get any stupider when we deal with these criminals. But every week, somebody proves me a little bit more wrong. Somebody goes out of their way to show us just how dumb truly can be. And guess where tonight's story starts off, Tim?
Let me think. Florida?
You are correct. We're going to Newport Richey, where a man was arrested for burglarizing several cars, including an occupied deputy's vehicle. I just want you to sit there and let that marinate for a second, Tim. See, a man was arrested for burglarizing several cars. One of those cars was a deputy's vehicle with a deputy inside it, Tim.
Oh, my.
Pasco County deputies arrested 49-year-old Stephen Titland on November 14th. They said several homeowners caught him attempting to enter seven vehicles on Hawbuck Street in Trinity Oaks. However, all vehicle doors were locked and nothing was stolen. On the following day, he attempted to enter an unmarked Pasco Sheriff's Office vehicle on Murrow Street in Newport Richey. However, it was occupied by deputies. First rule of Fight Club is don't talk about Fight Club. First rule of breaking and entering into cars, isn't it to make sure there's nobody in the car you're about to break into?
I think that's why they have windows. Yeah.
And at that point, is it really breaking in if you're just getting into a car where there are already people there? I don't know how this is going to play out, but I'm interested. Oh, my God. Titland was arrested and positively identified as a suspect involved in trying to burglarize seven vehicles in Trinity Oaks. Oh, God. His stupidity level reached an all-time high when the final vehicle he attempted to break into was an unmarked sheriff's office vehicle occupied by deputies. He was quickly taken into custody. Charges are pending. was a little bit of an anticlimactic ending for that story. This guy, wow. Isn't there a tint level on windows where you have to, if you can't see in the car, you're not supposed to have it tinted that dark, right?
Correct, yeah.
So if it was tinted dark enough, you couldn't see the cops inside of it. The cops were kind of illegal, too. I'll say I risk my case, Your Honor.
Foghorn Leghorn is the sheriff of Pasco County?
It sounds like it. I would like my client to be relieved from this situation. All right, we're going to go to Massachusetts, where the police department said a driver is facing charges for making their own license plate out of a pizza box and magic markers, Tim.
Well, who hasn't?
The Hopkinton Police Department said the driver of a Buick Century was pulled over when police noticed the vehicle's license plate was an obvious forgery. The Noid is not appearing on the license plate there?
No.
Pizza. The department said in a Facebook post, the driver is now facing charges. The post read, here's a little advice to those aspiring to make their own license plates. First, don't. Second, if you do, make sure not to use cardboard from a pizza box and magic markers. Charges for this creative operator include operating an uninsured and unregistered vehicle and attaching fake homemade plates.
Turns out the tip-off here, Dave, was actually the chew in Massachusetts was spelled C-H-O-O, like choo-choo train.
Isn't that how you spell it?
No.
Here's a story that'll warm your heart, Tim, and we're going to go all the way someplace kind of exotic and a little different for us. Palm Beach County, Florida.
Oh!
There were a few Palm Beach County drivers taking in stride the traffic troubles that came with President Trump's arrival in Florida on Tuesday night. Author and sports writer Jeff Perlman was stuck in traffic when he recorded two women exiting their vehicle just so they could twerk on Interstate 95. Perlman tweeted a video that said he was stuck off an exit when the booty-shaking exhibition occurred right in front of his car. The author said in a Periscope video that he was trying to get off the interstate to visit his favorite diner when they kept getting out of their car to dance. Actually, this is pretty good entertainment considering how sucky this is, said Perlman. Trump is in town through Sunday for Thanksgiving. So what was he saying? What was sucky? The part that Trump was in town through Sunday or the traffic jam? Which part do you think he was referring to?
It might have been both, actually. I think it's a toss-up. You know, I've heard, though, Dave, it's all part of the Trump for 2020 campaign. He's already looking forward to 2020. This was actually a fundraising campaign called Lady Humps for Trump. And, you'll see it all over the nation. It's twerking for Trump.
Dear Dave and Tim, I don't listen to your show for politics. I want to laugh and be removed from the real world. And now that I know that you are either pro or con against Trump, I can no longer listen to your show. Because I don't think we ever come down one way or the other.
It's a sense of humor, folks. It's what it's called. Yeah.
We'll get a couple of those.
Humps for Trump.
Yeah. That might not be the best title for it, though, in the current state of things. No. Here's a nice one. A blotto man. That means drunk, Tim. That means beyond drunk.
Oh.
Blotto man. In Sebastian Barr was convinced he was in Melbourne, cops say. He may have been lost, but he apparently was never lost for words. After refusing to go home, the bar staff called the cops to remove a very blitzed William Antonio Alaveri, who then told them several times he was a tax-paying citizen and, as such, they should find his car so he can drive home. That's what Sebastian cops are reporting. Reports the Sebastian Daily, when officers finally found his car, an agitated Oliveri told them he was driving home, but instead he got a ride to the slammer after cops found a little something on him, according to his arrest affidavit. Sebastian officers said Oliveira allegedly argued that he was in Melbourne, not Sebastian, even on the way to the pokey. So I like the fact that what he got arrested for was because he had something on him. They won't say what it is, Tim. What about the fact that you had to help a drunk man find his car?
That's pretty bad.
Then he was going to get in the car, and you were going to let him take off. Oh, but he had that cocaine.
Yeah.
Strapped to the taint.
Oh, God.
That would be my guess. I could be wrong. Speaking of drugs and taints, Tim.
Yeah.
A dealer with zero intelligence is caught after advertising cannabis on Facebook. He taint very smart, Tim. See where I went with that?
I see what you did.
A dealer with zero intelligence has been caught after advertising the drug for sale on Facebook. The would-be entrepreneur posted a picture of cannabis on a Facebook page called Portsmouth Cannabis to try and sell it. But the image was spotted by officers who quickly identified the location using evidence from the photo. After the cannabis was seized, Detective Superintendent Paul Barton, head of serious and organized crime at Hampshire Police Department, replied to the post. He said, 10 for 10 for entrepreneurial skills, 0 for 10 for intelligence. Police from the Cosham neighborhood team, Portsmouth, Hampshire, posted on Twitter, advertise the sale of cannabis on social media and expect a knock from us. Team Cosham removing drugs off our streets. The Portsmouth cannabis page posts include one talking about a little one from the weekend and a video of a $100 original gangsta shatter. And some mixed flower keef. Those are the different types, Tim.
Of
the marijuana.
I wasn't
aware. It also links to an Instagram page, which has more than 1,160 followers. Yeah, I'm just saying.
Otherwise known as suspects.
I like his title, though, Tim. Did you hear the title?
No, is that Portsmouth?
Yeah, hang on. Let me get back. Okay, he heads up the serious and organized crime.
Oh yeah,
he's the head of it. Head of serious and organized crime. Because the silly and redundant crimes, they need like two or three guys running that one.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. We have very little stories this week, Tim. Unfortunately, people took time off from being stupid and going to jail because of Thanksgiving. It would appear.
Well, you know what it was? There were a lot of people trying to figure out the difference between the head end and the ass end of the turkey. So that took away from a lot of the dumb crimes this week.
Well, here's a good one. Are you ready for this?
Ready.
We're going to go to Hot Springs, Arkansas, Tim.
Ooh, exotic.
A former Arkansas County employee who fraudulently spent more than $366,000 using a county credit card to buy personal items, including what for her dog, Tim? What did this former Arkansas County employee who fraudulently spent more than $366,000 using a county credit card, what did she buy for her dog?
I'm going to say a custom dog collar, maybe even diamond encrusted.
You're thinking a little small, son. If you're going to steal $366,000 and you want to be the fancy pants on the block, you got to think a little bigger. I'll give you one more chance at this. Former Arkansas County employee fraudulently spent more than $366,000 using a county credit card to buy personal items, including this for her dog.
Not just a dog house, Dave, but a custom dog palace.
Ooh, that would sound good. But no, Tim, that's a little... You go from one extreme to another, son. It's one thing or... No, she bought her dog a tuxedo.
What?
And she's been sentenced to 20 years of probation. Wait a minute. So you can blow $366,000 of county credit, and as long as you bought your dog a tuxedo, you only get 20 years probation?
That shows your humanity, Dave.
Court documents. That woman has a fancy dog, Tim. Court documents show 44-year-old Christy Goss was sentenced Wednesday after pleading guilty in September to using the card to purchase the dog tuxedo, a diamond bracelet, tickets to Arkansas Razorback sporting events, and to pay utility bills and auto payments. Goss was an administrative assistant for the Garland County judge in Hot Springs. Goss said she regrets her actions and that the stress of supporting her entire family, including that fancy damn dog, just became too much for her, Tim. He wouldn't leave me alone. He kept nagging me. He needed a tuxedo. He needed a tuxedo.
The dog was very demanding.
Wow.
I mean, yeah.
And I don't know that this is really a crime. I guess we'll see how it unfolds here, but it was sent to me as part of Dumb Crimes, Tim.
Okay.
We're going to Macomb, Mississippi. That's MS, right?
Why did you say it like
Mississippi.
Mississippi.
MS, is that Mississippi? I know it's multiple sclerosis, but in this case, Macomb, MS. No. That's Mississippi, correct?
I believe so.
But yeah. Michigan is MI, Minnesota, MN, Missouri, MO.
Right. Mississippi is MS.
MS. Okay. This is not a joke, Tim. They want us to know this straight up at the beginning of this article.
Okay.
From Dustin Barnes at the Clarion Ledger. Kying Major posted an item on Facebook on Monday, November 20th, and he admits it had one owner and is slightly used. At least he's honest. Anybody need a casket? One owner, slightly used, been down once for 3 years, just pulled up because we decided to go a different route. That's what the post reads. Could be the best Black Friday deal of the year.
Ew.
That's what Major is selling, the used casket for just $200. Now that is a steal. The question is, what does he mean when he says we decided to go a different route? It's a mystery, Tim. That's creepy. So first of all, I think the biggest scam on the planet is a coffin. Right? Let's just face it. It's a scam. You're going to go buy some case nobody's ever going to see again and bury it in the ground. It shouldn't matter what it looks like, outside or inside. Well, I want him to be comfortable. He's dead. They're not there. And truthfully, I would like it to be the most uncomfortable casket on the planet because I don't want to be down there and be like, oh, I kind of like this. I might just hang around. I think I want to, this is uncomfortable and smells of rotting pine. I think I shall go check out some other places. That's how I roll, Tim. Maybe I'm being too progressive in this case.
Maybe.
But if you're looking for a deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
When my mom passed away, my dad and I were quite shocked. They were like, oh, yes, we've got some beautiful coffins, some of them starting as low as $5,000.
Oh.
And I knew, we priced coffins before mom passed away. And I knew that had I come back and told mom, hey, we got you a $5,000 coffin, she would have killed the two of us. And then we'd have been out $15,000 because we'd have had to get three coffins. She would prefer to be, shot into space, but I couldn't afford that either. So we had her cremated, and I'm just going to sprinkle her ashes at places I'm probably not supposed to, Tim.
Oh, good.
Watch out, Disneyland. Here I come. But, yes, the coffins are obscenely priced. But would you buy a used coffin that's been in the ground for 3 years with a corpse that had been already in it?
Hell no.
$200. Tim, that's a steal.
Yeah. I don't want somebody else's stank in my area.
We want to go, let's just say, we're going to go a different way. Well, it's been 3 years. Haven't you already kind of committed at that point? This family has real, real big commitment issues, Tim. If like 3 years in, you're like, I don't know. Maybe we should have just shot her out of a cannon.
These are the same people that belonged to the Columbia House CD Club and got all the way until the final CD and decided to cancel.
I don't know what you're talking about. I probably have a criminal rap sheet because of signing up for that Columbia Record House thing. 99 cents for records, then tapes, and then I upgraded into CDs.
Yep.
Never paid. Never paid.
What?
Shh.
How could you?
Shh. Never paid. I got those 10 CDs. You know what my first CD was from them? Columbia
What's
House?
That?
Sports. By Huey Lewis in the News.
Oh, good choice.
Yeah, that was my first one. Hey, that's what's going on today on Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. I wish we had more to share, but we don't. Step it up, America. We need your stupidity. And remember, you can always send us storylines if you've got them and you've seen them. Make sure they're just new stories, sometimes in the last week or two. You can email them to us at dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com. And if you are offended by anything Tim said, just email him at tim@darknessradio.com. Send him nude pictures, preferably of horribly disfigured-looking people, whatever. He likes that stuff.
If you are part of the group Lady Humps for Trump, I'm taking audition tapes, too, as well.
God.
Send your videos to tim@darknessradio.com. I'd like to see them.
Today on Beyond the Darkness, we have strange tales of restless spirits of Rudolph Valentino, dogmen, possession, witchcraft, curses, and more with Kevin Scott Collier. That's today on Beyond the Darkness. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. Thank you for tuning in to True Crime Tuesday.